was told, well, he was surely no messenger, but in that instance he took on the role of a messenger, which must have been very painful for him. And he took the order in an envelope and drove his automobile out to the motel in Grand Ledge, and I learned later, handed it to Associate Justice Riley, who had no idea it was coming. She opened it, learned that she had been ordered off the Supreme Court by her six colleagues. And I also learned later, found herself not only in emotional isolation because of what had been done, but physically isolated. She had no car, no way to leave the motel. She called to Detroit for some transportation, and she left Lansing and left the court in what I then thought, think now, was the most inconsiderate and ignominious and painful fashion.
It was not a very glorious chapter in the court's history.
Not a very glorious chapter at all.
Part of it.
It does, except, of course, the human dimension at the end of it is that that was a very unsympathetic decision in terms of the public reception, and the court was criticized widely for what it did, and, of course, that doesn't matter. If the court was right, it doesn't matter whether it's criticized, but as everybody knows, in the next ensuing election, Dorothy Riley ran against our friend Thomas Giles Kavanaugh, and although Dorothy did not advert to it explicitly throughout the campaign, the theme the press used about that contest was that she was going to knock off one of the judges that threw her off the court. That was the handle on the story, and of course that's the way it worked out.
Well, that was there were opportunities for this matter to be raised when she went around.
Yes,
there were. Ask her about this.
Yes. Well, I just wanted to share one thought. I'm not totally sure it's part of the history of the Supreme Court, but it's relevant in the sense that it's part of my history in the court, and that is that the two statewide elections in which I was involved, 76 and 78, were horrendous experiences for me. I was very, very uncomfortable in trying to conduct a statewide campaign for an office for which there are no issues of any significance, there's no public interest of any kind. Statistically, a small minority of Michigan citizens are interested, and a relatively small minority of the registered voters even cast a ballot. Still, it's necessary to go around to Michigan's 83 counties and to campaign. I never did know how to campaign for a judicial office except all out at flank speed. One of my personal shortcomings is overdoing things a lot. In that scenario, I always overdid it. It was necessary to raise money. And the only people interested in giving money to a Supreme Court justice are lawyers and the candidate's friends. Oh, there are some individuals who, just out of respect for the process and the institution and the candidate, will make contributions, but by and large, the money comes from lawyers or it doesn't come from anybody. There is this feeling I had both in 76 and 78 when the money was being raised. There's something beyond unsavory, really improper, in the sitting justice going to lawyers frontally or even indirectly through a committee asking for financial contributions. Unspoken and implicit in all of it is that all of the justices, judges in Michigan, know that the lawyers feel they have to make contributions to these candidacies. It's a kind of genteel extortion. Lawyers in great numbers are afraid not to donate $100 to the candidacy of a sitting judge or justice, for fear that someday the justice might hold it against that lawyer if he declines. In addition to that, my appointment came from a Republican governor, and so I had the enthusiastic opposition of all of organized labor in the state of Michigan. The rules for contributing money to political campaigns operations. So it made the process very running very, very difficult. And not only was it a terrible distraction from my work because of the necessity to run around the state of Michigan for 7 or 8 months to conduct this campaign, making speeches to service clubs on radio stations, and political gatherings, partisan political gatherings in parks all over the state. I found myself standing next to the partisan candidate for Republican office or for Democratic office when they would let me in the hall. The candidates for governor and senator and legislator and congressman ahead of me would make promises to the audience as to what they would do if elected, and I would be called upon to speak. I wasn't able to make any promise of any kind as to what I would do, except to say I'd do my best, which would sound absurd to an audience who just heard a United States senator or a governor. I found this terribly distasteful and a waste of the court's resources to the extent I was a resource in 76 and 78, and I was terribly troubled by the fundraising. It finally came crunch time in my career, about my 10th year in the court. I was facing the prospect of a third statewide campaign in 1986, and I detested literally the idea of organizing committees, going to lawyers, begging for money to be wasted on nonsensical television ads that were designed to make me look attractive physically and to sound good, because I could have nothing to say ethically to win votes. But that was the process. The people in the state of Michigan seemed to want to go with that process. I had looked up the statistics, and the statistics had shown that in 1978, only about 40% of the voters who were inside the voting booth bothered to cast a ballot for anybody